In the late afternoon of the second day, he had reached a clearing, and he caught his first glimpse of the Wazungu. At first he thought it was one of the rare forest antelope on the opposite hillside. He caught just a tiny flicker of movement in one of the forest glades, almost a mile distant across the valley. For an instant, even Piri's phenomenal eyesight was cheated. It did not seem to be a man, certainly not a white man, and then as he disappeared into the tall trees at the edge of the forest, he realized that the man had covered himself with mud from head to foot and wore a hat of bark and leaves, which distorted the outline of his head and made it difficult to make out his human shape. "Ehe!" Piri rubbed his belly with delight and granted himself another small pinch of tobacco under his upper lip to reward himself for the sighting. "Oh, yes, you are good, my Wazungi. Even I will not be able to catch you before darkness falls, but in the morning your head will be mine." That night, Piri slept without a fire at the edge of the clearing where last he had seen the white man, and was moving again just as soon as it was light enough to make out the sign. In the middle of the morning he found the Wazungu. He was lying at the foot of one of the towering African mahogany trees, and at first Piri thought he was already dead. He had tried to cover himself with dead leaves, a pathetic last effort to thwart the remorseless little hunter. Piri moved in very slowly, taking every precaution, trusting nothing. He carried his broad-bladed machete ready in his right hand, and the weapon was honed to a razor edge. When at last he stood over Daniel Armstrong, he realized that although he was sick and wasted, he was not yet dead. He was unconscious, breathing with a soft bubbling sound in the back of his throat, curled like a sick dog under the blanket of leaf trash. His head was tilted at an angle, and the sweat had washed away the mud camouflage below his jawline, leaving a white line. A perfect aiming mark for the decapitating stroke. Piri tested the edge of the blade of the machete with his thumb. It was sharp enough to shave his beard. He lifted it high above his head with both hands. The man's neck was no thicker than one of the forest dikers, which were Piri's usual prey. The machete would hack through meat and bone just as readily, and the head would spring away from the trunk with the same startling alacrity. He would hang it by its thick curly hair from a branch for an hour or so to allow the blood to drain from the severed neck. Then he would smoke it over a slow fire of green leaves and herbs to preserve it, before slinging it in a small carrying net of bark string and bearing it back to his poaching master, Chetty Singh, to collect his reward. Piri felt a little cold gust of regret as he paused at the top of his stroke, before sending the blade hissing down. Because he was a true hunter, he always experienced the sadness for his quarry at the moment of the kill. The creed of his tribe was to respect and honour the animals he killed, especially when the quarry had been cunning and brave and worthy. "Die swiftly," he made his silent entreaty. He was on the point of slashing downwards when a voice said quietly behind him, "Hold your blade, my brother, or I will put this poison arrow through your liver." Piri was so startled that he leapt in the air and whirled to face about. Seppu was 5 paces behind him. His bow was arched, and the arrow was drawn to his cheek. The poison on the tip of the arrow was black and sticky as toffee, and it was pointed unwaveringly at Piri's chest. "You are my own brother," Piri gasped with a shock. "You are the fruit of my own mother's womb. You would not let your arrow fly?" "If you believe that, Piri, my brother, you are even more stupid than I believe you to be. Karakai wants this white Wazungu alive. If you tap a single drop of his blood, I will put this arrow through you from brisket to backbone." "And I," said Pamba, his wife from the forest shadows behind him, "I will sing and dance around you as you lie writhing on the ground." Piri backed away sharply. He knew he could talk Seppu into or out of almost anything, but not Pamba. He had a vast respect for and healthy fear of his sister-in-law. "They have offered me great treasure to kill this Wazungu." His voice was shrill. "I will share it equally with you, as much tobacco as you can carry. I will give it to you." "Shoot him in the belly," ordered Pamba cheerfully, and Seppu's arm trembled with the strain of his draw as he closed one eye to correct his aim. "Eh, wait!" shrieked Piri. "I love you, my dear sister. You would not allow this old idiot to kill me." "I am going to take a little snuff," said Pamba coldly. "If you are still here when I finish sneezing..." "I am going, I am going!" howled Piri, and took another 12 paces backwards. "I am going!" He ducked into the undergrowth, and the instant he was out of the line of fire, he screamed, "You foul old monkey woman!" They could hear him slashing out with his machete at the bushes around him in fury and frustration. Only a decrepit venereal baboon like Seppu would marry a drooling old hag! The sounds of his ranting fury gradually diminished as he retreated into the forest, and Seppu lowered his bow and turned to his wife. "I have not enjoyed myself so much since the day Piri fell into his own trap on top of the buffalo that was already in the pit," he guffawed. "But he described you well, my lovely wife." Pamba ignored him and went to where Daniel Armstrong lay unconscious, half buried in dirt and dead leaves. She knelt beside him and examined him quickly but thoroughly, plucking the ants from the corners of his eyes and his nostrils. "I will have to work hard to save him for Karakai," she said, as she reached into her medicine bag. "If I lose this one, I don't know where I will find another one for her." While Pamba ministered to Daniel, Seppu built a hut over him where he lay, and then lit a little fire to disperse the mosquitoes and the humidity. He squatted in the doorway and watched his wife work. She was the most skilled medicine woman of all the Bambuti, and her fingers were swift and dexterous as she cleaned the wound in the Wazungu's back and applied a poultice of mashed and boiled roots and leaves. Then she forced him to drink copious quantities of a hot infusion of herbs that would bind his bowels and replace the fluid that his body had shed. She crooned and muttered encouragement to the unconscious man as she worked, her bare dugs swinging, wrinkled and empty, as a pair of leather tobacco pouches from her bony chest, and her necklace of ivory and beads clicking each time she moved. Within 3 hours, Daniel had regained consciousness. He looked up dazedly at the two little old people crouched over him in the smoky hut and asked in Swahili, "Who are you?"
"I am Seppu," said the man, "a famous hunter and a renowned sage of the Bambuti. And I am Pamba, the wife of the greatest liar in all the forest of Ubomo," said the woman, and cackled with laughter.
By the next morning, Daniel's diarrhea had dried up, and he could eat a little of the stew of monkey meat and herbs that Pamba had prepared for him. By the following morning, the infection of the wound in his back had abated, and he was strong enough to begin the journey to Gondala. Daniel went slowly at first, using a staff to steady himself, for his legs were still wobbly, and his head seemed to be filled with wool and floating clear of his shoulders. Pamba kept him company, leading at a gentle pace through the forest, and keeping up a constant chattering punctuated with shrieks of merry laughter. Seppu ranged afar, hunting and scavenging in the usual Bambuti manner. Daniel had already guessed the identity of the mysterious Karakai, who had sent the pygmies to rescue her, but as soon as Pamba gave him an opportunity, he questioned her further, trying to get her to describe her patron in detail.
"Karakai is very tall," Pamba told him,
and Daniel realized that to a Bambuti, everybody else in the world is very tall.
"And she has a long pointed nose."
All Bambuti noses were flat and broad. Pamba's description could apply to any Wazungu, so Daniel gave up and hobbled on after the little woman. Towards dusk, Seppu suddenly appeared again from the forest with the carcass of a daika he had killed hanging over his shoulder. That night they feasted on grilled liver and fillets. The next morning, Daniel was strong enough to discard his staff, and Pamba increased the pace of the march. They reached Gondala the following afternoon. The pygmies had given Daniel no warning that they had arrived, and as he stepped out of the forest, he was presented with the dramatic view of the little community, its open gardens and streams, and the high snow-capped mountains forming a grand backdrop to the scene.
"Daniel," Kelly Kinnear greeted him as he climbed the veranda steps, and even though he had half expected it, Daniel was unprepared for his own pleasure at meeting her again. She looked fresh and vital and attractive, but he sensed a reserve in her as she came to him and shook his hand. "I was so worried that Seppu might not get to you in time." Then she broke off and stood back. "God, you look awful. What on earth happened to you?"
"Well, thanks for the compliment," he grinned ruefully. "But to answer your question, a great deal has happened to me since we last met."
"Come into the surgery. Let's have a look at you before we do anything else."
"Couldn't I have a bath first? I find it difficult even being near myself. She laughed. You are rather strong on the nose, but so are most of my patients. I'm used to it. She took him into the surgery and laid him on the examination table. After she had gone over him thoroughly and inspected the wound on his back, she remarked, Pumba has done a pretty good job. I'll give you a shot of antibiotic and I'll put a fresh dressing on your back after your bath. I should have had stitches, but it's too late for that now. You will have a new interesting scar to add to all the others. As she washed her hands in the basin, she smiled at him over her shoulder. You look as though you've been in a fight or two. Always the other guy's fault, he assured her. Talking about fights, you never let me explain myself at our last meeting. You jumped on your motorbike before I had a chance. I know. It's my Irish blood. Can I explain now? How about a bath first? The bathroom was a thatched hut, and the bath was a galvanized iron tub, just large enough to contain him if he kept his knees up under his chin. The camp servants filled it with buckets of steaming water heated on the fire outside. There was clothing laid out for him, khaki shorts and shirt, faded and worn, but clean and crisply ironed, together with a pair of rawhide sandals. One of the servants took away his stinking, blood-stained shorts and muddy boots. Kelly was waiting for him in her surgery when he had dressed. "What a transformation," she greeted him. "Let's fix that back." He sat on the single chair and she stood behind him. Her fingers were cool and light and quick on his skin. When she spoke, he could feel her breath on the back of his neck and smell her. He liked the feel of her hands and the sweet, clean smell of her breath.
"I didn't thank you for sending your pygmies to save my life," he said.
"All in a day's work. Think nothing of it."
"I owe you one.
I'll call on you."
"You were the very last person I'd have expected to find here," Daniel told her. "But when Pumba described you, I began to suspect who you were. How did you get into the country, and what the hell are you doing here? If Tafari gets hold of you, it'll be a shooting party on the beach, or a headdress of hornets."
"Oh, so you're beginning to find out the truth about Ephraim Tafari, that he's not the saint and saviour you thought he was."
"No, don't let's fight again," he pleaded. "I'm still too weak to defend myself."
"You're as weak as a bull. Look at all that muscle."
"Okay, now it's time for your shot. Lie on the bed and drop your shorts."
"Hey, can't I have it in the arm?"
"You haven't got anything I haven't seen before. Come on, get on the table."
Grumbling, he lay face down and lowered his shorts halfway.
"Nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, not bad at all," she assured him, and slid the needle home. "Okay, that does it. Get dressed and come to dinner. I've got another surprise for you.
A dinner guest. Somebody you haven't seen for years."
In the sunset, they crossed from the clinic to Kelly's living quarters at the end of the clearing. On the way, they stopped for a minute to watch the sunset turn the mountains of the moon to a splendour of golden flames.
"I carry the memory of this beauty wherever I travel in the world," Kelly whispered. "It's one of the things that draws me back."
And Daniel was moved as much by her reaction to it as by the grandeur of the scene itself. To express his accord with her, he wanted to take her arm and squeeze it, but he kept his distance, and after a while they moved on.
There was a dinner table laid on the veranda of Kelly's bungalow, and a solitary figure seated at it, who rose as they approached.
"Dr. Armstrong, how good to see you again."
Daniel stared at him in astonishment, and then hurried forward.
"I heard that you were dead, Mr. President, that you died of a heart attack or been shot by Tafari."
"The news of my death was slightly exaggerated," Victor Omeru chuckled, and took Daniel's hand.
"I found a flask of whiskey in my medical chest," Kelly said. "Tonight seems like an auspicious occasion to administer it."
She poured a little of the golden liquid into each of their glasses and offered them the toast.
"To you, Bomo. May it soon be released from the tyrant."
Dinner was a simple meal of fish from the river and vegetables from the gardens of Gondala. But there was plenty of it, and the conversation at the table never slackened or palled. Victor Omeru explained to Daniel all the circumstances of the revolution and his overthrow, his escape into the forest, and his activities since then. With Kelly's help, I have been able to turn Gondala into the headquarters of the resistance to Tafari's brutal dictatorship, he ended. But Kelly pressed him eagerly.
Victor, tell Daniel what Tafari has done to the country and its people since he seized power. Daniel has been duped into believing that Tafari is a black Christ figure. In fact, Daniel is here to shoot a production that was to extol Tafari's virtues.
No, Kelly, Daniel interrupted her. That's not the way it was. It's far more complicated than that. Originally, I accepted the commission to make the film for personal and private reasons. He went on to explain the murder of Johnny Inzu and his family. He told them of Ning Cheng Gong's involvement and how he had traced the lucky dragon to Ubomo. He told them about Chetty Singh. I'll be frank with both of you, he said at last. I wasn't concerned with Tafari and Ubomo's real problems when I came here. I wanted my revenge, and the film contract was only a means to that end. Then, after my arrival, I began to find out more about what was really going on in the country. He told them about the atrocity at Fish Eagle Bay, and the forced labour he had witnessed and filmed. Victor, Omeru, and Kelly exchanged glances, and then Victor nodded and turned back to Daniel.
Tafari has seized at least 30,000 of the Yuhali people to work in the mines and the logging camps. They are slaves, kept in the most appalling conditions. They are dying like flies in the camps, starved, beaten, and shot. I cannot begin to describe to you the horror of it.
And he's devastating the forest, Kelly cut in. He's destroying millions of acres of the rainforest.
Well, I saw their mining unit at work, Daniel said. Actually, what he's doing there, at least, is in line with my own convictions on controlled use of a country's natural assets on a renewable and sustainable yield basis.
Both Kelly and Victor stared at him in disbelief. And then Kelly blurted out angrily, "You approve of what he's doing to the forest? Are you out of your mind? It's rape and pillage. I was right about you the first time. You are one of the plunderers."
"Hold it, Kelly," Victor held up his hands. "Don't use inflammatory language. Let Daniel tell us what he saw and what he filmed." With an obvious effort, Kelly brought herself under control. But she was still pale with anger, and her eyes blazed. "All right, Daniel Armstrong, tell us what Tafari showed you and let you film."
"He showed me the Momu unit at work."
"The Momu?" Kelly interjected. "Momu singular?"
"Kelly, please," Victor stopped her again. "Let Daniel finish before you interrupt."
She was breathing heavily, but she nodded and sat back as Daniel went on.
"Bonnie and I filmed the Momu, and Tafari explained how the track of the vehicle would be replanted after it had passed."
"Replanted?"
Kelly snapped, and Victor shrugged helplessly and let her continue.
"My God, did he tell you about the chemical reagents they've started using in the past few weeks to refine the platinum as it passes through the tube mills of the Momu?"
"No," Daniel shook his head. "He told us of his determination that no reagents or catalysts were to be used during the mining process, even though it meant a 40% drop in the production of platinum and monazite."
"And you believed him?" Kelly demanded.
"I saw it with my own eyes," Daniel told her. He was starting to get angry. "I filmed it. Of course I believe him."
Kelly jumped up from the table and fetched a map of Ubomo from the next room. She spread it in front of Daniel.
"Show me where you saw the Momu in action," she ordered.
Daniel considered the map and then placed his finger on a spot just north of Sengi Sengi.
"Hereabouts," he said, "a few miles north of the camp."
"Sucker," Kelly blazed at him. "Tafari set you up. He showed you the pilot scheme. It was a little show for your benefit. The main mining operation is here."
She placed her fist over an area 50 miles further north.
"Here at Wengu. And it's a damn sight different from what Tafari showed you."
"Well, how is it different?" Daniel demanded.
"And by the way, I don't like being called a sucker."
"You let yourself be conned," Kelly moderated her tone. "But I'll tell you how the main operation is different from the pilot. First of all, it's..."
"Hold on, Kelly," Victor Omeru intervened gently. "Don't tell him about it. It would be much more impressive, and he'd be more likely to believe you if you showed him."
For a moment, Kelly stared at Victor, and then she nodded. "You're right, Victor. I'll take him up to Wengu and show him. And while we're there, you can film just what that bastard is doing to the forest, and show it to your great pal Sir Tug Bloody Harrison, if he doesn't know already."
"I'm not a cameraman," Daniel objected.
If you don't know how to use a VTR after being around them for so many years, then you aren't very bright, Dr. Daniel. All right, I could use a camera, not very artistically, but adequately. If only I had one. Where do you suggest I find a VTR in the middle of the forest? What happened to the one your red-haired girlfriend had? Kelly demanded. Bonnie isn't my girlfriend. You're a great one for hurling accusations, he began, and then broke off and stared at Kelly. Damn it, he said. You're right. I left the VTR in the Land Rover. If Tafari's lads haven't found it yet, then it's still there. Why don't you go back and fetch it? Kelly inquired sweetly. I'll send Sipu with you.